Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen MacRamos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. We're kicking off this week's episode with one of the biggest news stories this week, Ichiro's decision to stop playing Major League Baseball in favor of assuming a front office position with the Mariners. Here to reminisce with us about his incredible career is a name and voice near and dear to our hearts. She's Hardball Times managing editor and Fangraphs contributor, Meg Rowley. How are you doing today, Meg?
I'm good. I, in thinking about this, was watching the Mariners win in sort of dramatic walk-off fashion yesterday. And as, you know, the Root Sports Cam, like, found Ryan Healy being very excited and D. Gordon just being, like, a little jumping bean, the camera panned, and there was Robinson Cano, like, in a warm embrace with Ichiro. And I just was thinking how unusual and kind of cool, certainly an elegant solution to a self-imposed problem, their decision to transition him to the front office has been, because there he was in uniform, just, like, hanging with his buddy, being excited about a walk-off win. It's a weird time, but it's kind of cool to see him still out there and clearly still embraced by his, I guess, technically former teammates at this point. So,
speaking of weird times, as with many international signees, Ichiro had an interesting path to Major League Baseball. What do you remember about his first couple of seasons with the Mariners?
It's funny because when he was in his first spring training with the Mariners, there was, you know, a fair amount of skepticism that this could work. And there was even skepticism being sort of expressed by his manager. I mean, Lou Piniella was sort of sitting there watching him roll over grounders and figure out kind of what he was doing, and was a little like, who is this guy? What are we going to get? I mean, to say that, like, he was good right away is sort of an understatement. I mean, he's one of the few people in baseball's history who's won an MVP and a Rookie of the Year at the same time. And I think that Mariners fans were sort of optimistic. We'd heard sort of about his storied career in Japan. But he was just such a cool, weird combination of things. I mean, I remember watching that 2001 team when I was in high school. And, you know, you had this guy who felt like a throwback in a lot of ways, right? And this is sort of a widely remarked upon aspect of Ichiro's career, where he was sort of, you know, the slap hitting guy who would just beat out a bunch of infield hits. And you know, that was the sort of offensive value he was largely contributing. But then he also had this cannon of an arm, and right. And so the contrast of this, you know, sort of more modest, speed-based contact approach with this guy who, you know, could sort of famously gun guys down at third from right field was just a very cool and weird and interesting combination of things. And I think contributed to the perception that his statement that he could, like, hit a bunch of home runs if he wanted to was probably an accurate one, because we saw a version of strength, even if it wasn't when he was in the batter's box, when he was out playing the field. So it was just, it was magical. I mean, he was just this magical guy in a magical season, right? He wasn't sitting in this context of having to sort of replace Alex Rodriguez, even though he's a completely different kind of player. And yet there he was, presenting a very different version of the game, but one that was, I think, a really fun and underrated skill set. I'm talking a lot, so I'll let you ask another question in a second. But I'm struck this year as Mariners fans are watching D. Gordon, obviously, you know, not the player that Ichiro was, but that skill set of a guy who's just, like, constantly churning and getting on base, I think is one that we underappreciate for its aesthetic value. Like, it's really fun to have a guy who feels like he's always on base, you know, and then is fast and can do stuff on the base paths. You know, that wasn't that was a big part of his game too, that I think we don't talk about. So it's fun to see in the current Mariners a sort of throwback to a version of the game that we associated as a throwback with Ichiro, but I think still has a place. That was a sort of long and rambling answer.
No, I mean, I think that really sort of encapsulates what fascinated us so much about Ichiro, certainly as a player. And I think as fascinating as we find Ichiro as what we see on the field, we also think that he's got this really sort of interesting personality that very much comes through in how you know, his teammates talk about him, how, you know, the various anecdotes that we've heard about him. And one thing that we know about him is, you know, he's retiring here, or not retiring, but he's kind of stepping aside here without that much fanfare. Now, you know, with this sort of in contrast to some of the other more high profile retirements that we've seen recently. So if Ichiro were to have a sudden personality shift and desire a retirement tour a la Derek Jeter or David Ortiz, what teams do you think would give him the best gifts?
Oh, gosh. I have to think that the Yankees would sort of do right by him. He was clearly beloved by his Marlins teammates. I mean, Dee Gordon was incredibly excited when Ichiro was announced as coming back to the Mariners so that he had a chance at a reunion. I would like to think that Cleveland could have some fun with it. You know, Ichiro sort of famously said that if he ever was quoted as saying he looked forward to playing there, that he would be lying. So I'd like to think that Cleveland could have a bit of fun and not be too self-serious about it. I'd like to see what their tribute might look like. I don't know. I think those might be at the top of the list for me. It's interesting because he is such a universally beloved figure in the game. And we do have this sense that, like, he is imbued with an interesting and dynamic personality, and we hear all these anecdotes. But I think, and I might write about this for Fangraphs a little later in the week, one of the things that I've always found sort of interesting about him, especially as his career has sort of been winding down and it's clear that he's in sort of the twilight phase of it, I think that unlike maybe any other baseball player I can think of in recent memory, you know, Ichiro had a relationship with the fan base in Seattle. I think that Seattle is genuinely and sort of authentically dear to him. It's clear that he wanted to sort of conclude his time in the majors in Seattle. And so I think that there is a deep connection. But in a lot of ways, I've always thought of Ichiro's primary sort of relationship as being with baseball proper. And part of why I think he was so keen to keep playing was that he seemed to be in search of an answer to the question of, like, is the game really, truly, and fully done with me? And so I'm not surprised that he didn't feel the need to, like, have a whole retirement tour and go through all this fanfare. Because I think in a lot of ways, like, that wasn't really what it was about for him. You know, he wasn't really trying to prove things to other people. You know, he was mostly trying to prove things to himself in a way that I think didn't really necessitate a bunch of pomp and circumstance. And it's interesting that a guy who is sort of, you know, reserved in a lot of ways, has given us these tantalizing glimpses into a really interesting and dynamic personality, but has been kind of reserved in a lot of ways and just had these fits and starts of exposing, you know, who he is to the media, would be that guy who is so universally beloved. Like, I can't think of a fan base that genuinely hates Ichiro, right? Like, he doesn't, I mean, he was, like, kind of rude about Cleveland, but, like, Cleveland's used to that. So, like, you know, I can't think of a fan base that's like, that Ichiro, don't like that guy. Like, everyone loves Ichiro. And I think it's interesting that they would, because I think fans like to feel needed, and we like guys to sort of appreciate in an obvious way the privilege of what they're getting to do, which is play professional baseball. And I think a lot of them do, but they, you know, I think fans expect that the expression of that is going to be sort of preening, and Ichiro was clearly not interested in that. You know, he was having a conversation with baseball. He wasn't necessarily having a conversation with all of us about baseball. And so he's just, like, a really cool, weird, interesting dude. And it's great. And I'm sad that he will be leaving in a meaningful way, right? Like, his meaningful baseball days are behind him now. And I was very nervous about what this signing would do to sort of his legacy with the organization. Cause, you know, apart from Griffey and Edgar, I can't think of a more beloved Mariner than Ichiro. And in a way that's sort of less complicated than it was with Griffey. And so I was, you know, I was kind of bummed out that they had brought him back for, like, to cover a 5-week oblique injury to Ben Gamel. So this seems like a sort of elegant solution to a problem, like I said, that was self-imposed, or self-inflicted rather, but it's nice that he gets to still be on the field in a way that feels like it means something, you know, in a way that isn't mascot-y. So
Ichiro. Yeah. Do you have any favorite Ichiro on field or off field moments?
Well, I'll tell a personal story, which is the off field one. My younger brother is not much of a baseball fan, and so, you know, when I have interactions with him around baseball that are really positive, it makes me happy because, you know, it just doesn't happen very often. And when he was a little guy, he's much younger than I am, he was like, I don't know, let's see, it was 2001 when Ichiro signed, so he probably started doing this around 2004. We would go to games at Safeco and we would ask Cole, like a little baby Cole would be like, Cole, who are you going to go see? And he'd go, Ichiro, which is how people would cheer for Ichiro in the stands. So it was pretty adorable and lovely. I mean, I think that like my favorite on-field moment is still, there are two. My favorite on-field moment that, you know, everyone kind of remembers is his amazing throw to nab a runner at third in, I guess that was his first season, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably my favorite on-field moment that everyone still remembers, and you know, it's been retweeted a bunch in the last week as sort of word has come around that this would be his last time with the Mariners. But yeah, when he caught Terrence Long, that was pretty special. And then he had a walk-off home run against Mariano Rivera that is probably one of the best baseball things I have ever seen, in a year when the Mariners were just god awful, you know, just really very, very bad at baseball. And you know, here's Ichiro, famously not a home run hitter, as we've all discussed. And, you know, this was a team that, like, it was sort of outperforming, kind of. Like, they were, I think that 2009 Mariners team, I'm looking at it now, like, they were expected to win 75 games, but they ended up winning 85. And it all comes down to moments like this, where, like, of all people to take Mariano Rivera deep on a walk-off. I think that is the only walk-off home run? No. One of the only ones that Mariano Rivera ever gave up. And it's Ichiro, of all people. And he was just swarmed at home plate. Like, you know, that was during, like, the Adrian Beltre Mariners. So you get this really great moment of, like, Adrian Beltre freaking out at home plate when Ichiro has walked off the Mariners against Mariano Rivera. So that one's pretty famous in, like, Mariners lore. I think it's a little lesser known to the broader baseball world because, like, who gives a crap about the 2009 Mariners? But I think those might be my favorites. That was pretty great. Yeah, he was very excited.
I was watching that game. I don't know why I decided to sit down and watch a 2009 Yankees game as a Red Sox fan that, you know, was designed to not bring much joy to me. But just to see that happen was incredible. It was just such a great moment because of how improbable it was and because the Yankees lost, which is always great. So you've talked a lot about Ichiro and how integral he is to these Mariners teams, and how integral he is to just the narrative that you know, baseball has adopted during his time in Major League Baseball. But is there ever going to be an adequate expression of how much he has meant to the Mariners?
I mean, I think that you see what he means to that team every day at the ballpark. I mean, they're not alone in this, but, you know, when they signed him and they brought him over and he, you know, he was the first position player from Japan to play, and the presence that you felt in the ballpark of, the Japanese community in Seattle was out in a way that you just hadn't experienced before. And I think that it's allowed the Mariners to maintain a relationship with a diverse fan base in a way that, you know, even when Ichiro hasn't been there, has been really kind of wonderful and important to see. You know, some of this is obviously by virtue of who was in their ownership group, but like you go to the ballpark and when they have the little pocket schedules at like the information kiosk, they're in English, they're in Spanish, and they're in Japanese. And it's, I think, an aspect of the fan base that the team has really embraced and has you know, sort of opened them up to embracing other parts of a diverse fan base. And so I think in some ways that might be one of the most enduring parts of his legacy with Seattle, which is that, you know, that ballpark has a lot of different folks in it on any given night. And I think that is really happy to see a diverse fan base and to let guys sort of embrace the parts of their own identities that would connect them to, you know, their own communities. And I think that's really cool. I mean, I don't mean to make a claim that the Mariners are, you know, singular in their ability to do that, because I think a lot of teams are either getting better at it or are good at it now. But, you know, it's a really cool thing to get to see. And it's one of the parts of his time with Seattle that I'll always be grateful for, because I think that they were kind of ahead of the curve in a lot of ways with, you know, looking at their players as individuals who might have a special connection by virtue of where they're from or who they are. And I think that's a really cool thing for him to get to lay claim to in his legacy with the team. So
now looking at his relationship to the team and what it is now, there's been some speculation that he might put his cleats back on at the start of next season when the Mariners play in Tokyo. Do you think that's what's going to happen? Do you think he's actually done playing? Do you think there's any way he can possibly pass up the opportunity to do that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that people who are in the Ichiro prediction business tend to make fools of themselves pretty quickly, because he is someone who sort of does things his own way. But I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, they have an expanded roster when they're in Tokyo, so they have the ability to do it. But I think it'll be interesting to see. I mean, like I said, I think he's been trying to answer this question for himself of whether or not the game is really done with him yet. And I think that, you know, his transition to the front office is part of that answer. But sometimes it takes us a while to accept hard answers to questions. And so it'll be really interesting to see sort of where he's at sort of emotionally when it comes time for them to travel over to Japan. But I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if we see at least one more at bat from him, because that would be a pretty cool and special moment. I mean, the symbolism of being able to take it sort of full circle like that seems like it would be hard to resist, even for someone who doesn't seem, you know, especially prone to sentimentality. So I don't know. It'll be fun to watch. It'll be fun to see.
Having that idea, you know, the possibility in the future that Ichiro might be, you know, playing again in Tokyo, it's, while, of course, you know, a prediction, is still cool to think about.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today to talk all things Ichiro. You can follow Meg on Twitter at Meg Rowler. Once again, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We hit a big milestone this week. On Friday night, Albert Pujols picked up his 3,000th career hit. He singled to right field in the fifth inning of Friday's game against the Mariners, and in doing so, became the 32nd Major League Baseball player and second Dominican-born player to reach the milestone. He is now the fourth player to record 3,000 hits and 600 home runs, joining Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Alex Rodriguez. So what are our thoughts on his career?
When I think about baseball and growing up watching baseball, I think about how dominant Albert Pujols was. And I know that he has declined quite steeply in the past couple of seasons. And people like to kind of poke fun at how absurd his contract is compared to the actual output. But I think that his career is just absolutely remarkable. And he was so dominant for so long that you know, it's difficult to envision him as being anything other but, you know, an absolutely brilliant player.
Yeah, this is clearly a guy who's going into the Hall of Fame, you know, notwithstanding some subpar seasons with the Angels. And the thing is, he hasn't even really been that bad with them. He obviously hasn't been performing to the level that he was in his, like, actual superstar days with the Cardinals. But he has been certainly above average pretty much every season except for last. And, you know, this season he hasn't quite gotten there yet. Maybe he won't. You know, maybe this actually is kind of nearing the end for him. It's, you know, who knows? You can assume everything's going to work out one way and it just might not, because that's baseball. But, you know, I think it's pretty hard to deny that it's been a mostly remarkable career for him. He's put up some just amazing numbers. Looking at his baseball reference page, you know, you see a pretty decent amount of black ink on there. And, you know, he's just a guy that we're lucky that we've got to watch him, because in his prime, he was amazing to watch. And even in his later years, you know, he still is providing things like this, you know, letting us see his 600th home run, you know, his 3000th hit. And that's always exciting. And, you know, they're things that are pretty much going to make him a surefire, not a first ballot or very early Hall of Famer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, for all things people might say about his contract, I think, you know, considering his legacy already, what is there really to complain about if he's still putting up pretty decent numbers considering everything? I think that he, while, you know, no player is ever going to be as good as they were in their prime, the fact that Pujols is still doing this great, you know, at his age and at his performance level, is still something that we should be talking about and celebrating, because that's just how good he is. And the fact that he's the fourth player to record 3,000 hits and 600 home runs is a testament to his abilities on the field. So I think, you know, I agree with everything that's already been said, and, you know, it's just fun. It's just absolute joy to watch players like these.
Yeah. So, I also want to amend my previous statement. He's, like, the basically best first baseman of all time by a number of measures, like, second to only Lou Gehrig. Mm-hmm. Like, just, you know, so I retract my statement about him possibly being a first ballot Hall of Famer. He's definitely a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at this point, just by the, you know, the player value measures and his number of hits and home runs and just everything, he's absolutely a first ballot Hall of Famer. So Miguel Cabrera is now the next closest to 3,000 hits with 2,666. It seems like it's a pretty sure thing that he'll hit the benchmark, but how quickly do we think he'll do it?
I would say it all depends. This is going to sound so obvious, but it all depends on, like, how many games he plays per season, because he had a little bit of a drop-off, obviously, last season. But he's on pace now, I think, this season to be around where he was last season in terms of games played. And he hit 117 hits last season, so I would say probably he'll get there in about 3 or 4 seasons.
Yeah, I think that seems like a decent estimate. You know, it's another 300 plus 334. I can do math. It's another 334 hits that he needs. And, you know, if you're averaging about 100 hits a season, upwards of 100 hits a season, I should say, then yeah, I think that an estimate of about 3-4 seasons seems about spot on. And again, if he's actually kind of refound something close to the form that he had at the peak of his career, then yeah, it could be even less than that. But I think 3 years is probably a decent and yet still sort of conservative estimate.
Yeah, I agree. I think as long as, you know, he can stay healthy, but I don't know if we can really predict if a player is going to stay healthy because injuries happen. I think, you know, a conservative estimate would be everything that was said before. With the way his career has been, it's definitely likely that he will do it. It's just a matter of, like, staying healthy and how well, you know, the team is and the roster and playing time and all of that, and just a lot of other unpredictable intangibles. On Friday, it was still a busy night in baseball. South of the border in the Dodgers-Padres-Mexico series, the Dodgers threw a combined no-hitter. It's the first time in baseball history there has been a no-hitter and a 3,000th hit in the same day. Rookie Walker Buehler, in his third major league start, pitched the first six innings before being lifted at 93 pitches. Tony Cingrani, Yimi Garcia, and Adam Liberatore.
Everyone struggles with that one.
Pitched the remaining three innings to complete the feat. This was the first combined no-hitter since 2014, the fourth since 2000, and the 12th in MLB history. How much of the no-hitter can we attribute to you being unable to watch the game, Sarah?
Okay, so here's the thing about this. The Dodgers, in my lifetime, think it's been five no-hitters before this one. Three of them were like in their 90s. I was a child. I wasn't paying attention to baseball. I don't count those. I mean, they count obviously for like Dodger history, but in terms of, you know, my involvement, because that's what is important here, obviously, I don't consider them as much. The first one since Nomo's in 1996 was Josh Beckett's in May of 2014. And that happened the day that I was flying back from college to like come home and return to LA for good. And it was like a thing where I was following it on my phone and, you know, couldn't watch it, but I had game day and I was like, ah, man, of course this is happening when I can't watch it. Like the first Dodger no hitter in like, you know, 18 years and I can't watch it. Like, of course. And then less than a month later, I end up at Clayton Kershaw's no hitter. So I don't know if like there was some deal I accidentally made with the universe where I, by being at Clayton Kershaw's no-hitter in person, I will never get to actually watch another Dodger no-hitter. Like, they'll still happen. I just won't get to watch them. If that's what happened, I'm honestly fine with that. You know, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. But yeah, it's possible, is what I'm saying, that this happened because I couldn't watch it. But also, it might not have had anything to do with me, you know. The universe doesn't actually revolve around me, despite how I've been talking about this. But yeah, I'm glad that it's a thing that happened, because the Dodgers needed something good right now. Oh my God, you guys, Clayton Kershaw is on the disabled list, and it is the third worst thing to happen to the Dodgers this week. Like, that is the state of this team right now.
Maybe, again, it's kind of like a karma type thing, or like, you know, you have to balance certain things. So if they hadn't gotten this no-hitter, he would be fine.
You know what? I think that is exactly correct. I think that the no-hitter cursed the Dodgers in an already cursed season. And yeah, they shouldn't have done it, actually.
I'm glad we've come around to this.
I'm glad that we were able to suck the joy out of the, like, one good thing the Dodgers have had this season.
So, going back to the no-hitters, how do combined no-hitters compare to regular no-hitters?
I think that there's a lot of people who believe that combined no-hitters are cheaper no-hitters than regular ones. But I think they're still pretty special. Obviously, there have been far fewer combined no-hitters, but that's, you know, to do with a lot of factors, not just how difficult it is for, like, you know, three or four pitchers to not allow a hit in a game. So I think they're still pretty entertaining, and it's still quite a feat for the people involved.
Yeah, and the thing is, all no-hitters are team efforts. And I think a combined no-hitter just sort of forces us to realize that in a way that a no-hitter thrown entirely by one pitcher maybe doesn't as much. But the thing is, in every no-hitter, you know, you have like some incredible play that, you know, some bang-bang throw or some great catch that keeps the no-hitter intact. Like, that's pretty much how it always seems to go. And while people will acknowledge that, it's still, the credit goes entirely to the pitcher. Whereas in a combined no-hitter, it's like you literally have to say, okay, it wasn't just this guy, it was these four guys. And, you know, that obviously doesn't necessarily take into account what the other things that happened to preserve it. But I think that it nonetheless sort of forces us to look at the act of the no-hitter a little bit differently and realize that it's not one guy who made it happen. So yeah, I think there's something cool about that. You know, I would probably choose one person no-hitters over combined no-hitters myself, but nonetheless, I think that that's sort of a cool aspect of the combined no-hitter.
Yeah, I think with a combined no-hitter, it adds this extra layer of anxiety, because
that's what we want in a game, you know, to sit there being like, this is so stressful.
Because for me, when I'm watching, like, I remember watching Jonathan Sanchez's no-hitter in 2009, which was already an improbable no-hitter, and it was like the first in like 30 years for the Giants. I just remember that, like, when they had someone warming up in the bullpen, I was like, oh my god, what if he comes in? What if it's not going to be a no-hitter anymore? I mean, it was a perfect game until Juan Uribe error, but it was like, what happens? And then, like, watching combined no-hitters, I'm like, oh my god, this guy was already doing good, but this new guy is coming in, what's going to happen? Are they going to give up a hit? And it's just this feeling of, like, always being on edge and not being sure if this reliever is going to be able to, you know, put up the same mastery as the starter. And I'm just like even more tense and on edge than I would be with, you know, a one pitcher no hitter. So for that aspect alone, I don't know if I like combined no hitters more than regular no hitters. I feel like it's like comparing a roller coaster with a Ferris wheel. Both still pretty terrifying if you're afraid of heights like I am. But it's just kind of like the speed of it. This is the weirdest analogy I've come up with.
But I have no idea what that even looks like.
I don't know. This is like the first thing that came to my head. But it feels like a one-pitcher no-hitter is kind of like a Ferris wheel where you're like, okay, I know this is happening. I'm going to get to the top soon. I'm still going to feel really anxious and I might throw up. And we're going to keep doing that every half inning. Whereas with, like, a combined no-hitter, it's a roller coaster. You don't know what's going on and there's going to be drops and you're just going to keep going at fast speed. And I don't know where I'm going with this.
No, I think that makes sense. I wasn't, like, when you said it, I was like, what? But you know what? I'm on board with this analogy now.
Same. Your description really brought me on board. The initial outline of the thing, I was, you know, nowhere near where you were going, but now I'm safely on the old roller coaster with you.
And it's like, that's just how it feels for me, is like, okay, it's a steady anxiety. Okay, I can deal with that. Combined no-hitters, all right, let's throw everything out the window. So yeah, I think there's two different kinds of enjoyment with the types of no-hitters, but in the end, I'm still going to want to throw up.
I can't
Fair
even
enough.
Yeah.
So do you think we'll see more combined no-hitters with the increasing prominence of bullpens?
We're going to ride this roller coaster over and over again. Is that what you're getting at here? yeah, you know, I think we've seen an uptick in no-hitters recently, and we're also seeing an uptick in bullpen usage. And it is easy to see how those two things might come together and make this a less unusual feat going forward. You know, I think the rise in no-hitters, it's tied to the rise in, you know, this sort of three true outcome form of baseball that we're seeing more and more of, where it's like guys are trying to put the ball in the air and hit home runs and, you know, maybe not do that exclusively, but that's kind of the effect of what happens. And as a result, you know, it if you're trying to get a very specific kind of hit, you know, that makes the likelihood of a lot of hits go down. And I guess that follows that more no-hitters are going to happen as a result of that. But also we're seeing starters being given much shorter leashes and teams putting much heavier reliance on bullpens, and having so much more focus on specialists in the bullpen as well, who are like in their design specifically to get certain sorts of batters out. So yeah, I guess those things taken together, I wouldn't be surprised if the number increased from 12 within the next few seasons. But yeah, it'd be cool if we got two in one season. I don't think that's happened before.
I mean, I think Dave Roberts alone is going to manage at least six more of these.
Oh, Lord.
That just seems to be his luck.
Yeah, that seems like what is it with like his pitchers who are like, all right, I'm going to throw like a great game, but I'm also going to do it and hit like a pitch limit to the point where like I've had injuries, I'm a rookie, whatever, I can't go beyond this. And putting Roberts in the difficult decision of having to take another pitcher out of a no-hitter. And like, it's weird because I think in the case of Buehler, like, I feel like for the most part people weren't overly upset about it because there was an understanding like, okay, this kid's a rookie, it's his third major league start. Although I guess in Ross Stripling's case they didn't have that kind of understanding, but in that case, Ross Stripling also had the game blown for him after that. So, you know, I think when the end result works out the way that you want it to, it's a lot easier to look at it and be like, okay, that was the right decision. Anyway, I've gone off on a tangent now. Basically, this is a weird thing that's like going to be part of Dave Roberts' legacy. And I don't think anyone could have guessed that was going to be the case, but that's just how it goes.
I think it's great because he's kind of opening up baseball writers to examine new stats that people haven't really thought about. So now we're just going to get like a bunch of new things about managers who have like managed the most no hitters and like so on and so forth. And I just love, you know, those elements of baseball.
I will say that, you know, I also would like to thank Dave Roberts and Ross Stripling because it brought the awareness of Bumpus Jones into public consciousness, and just because his name is Bumpus Jones. But as for combined no-hitters, I think there will be an increase, especially with the bullpen's role being elevated. I'm just worried about the managers who already have terrible bullpen management and them managing a combined no-hitter. Like, I am just thinking about the nightmare that will be Bruce Bochy if he ever has to manage a combined no-hitter. And he used to have such great bullpen management, and now I just want to throw things at the TV or throw popcorn in the air, which I won't do, at AT&T Park because, my God, the bullpen over management.
I'm imagining
he's going to pull people like after every single out, like a new
pitcher.
Yeah.
No, not every single out, every single pitch.
Yeah, it'll be like a bunch of mid at bat pitching changes in the midst of a combined no-hitter. That is what Bruce Bochy is going to do to us.
The last two innings are going to take like 6 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, so with going back to the amusement park analogy, the only thing I can think of is like that ride that just goes like straight up slowly and then drops you down. That's what I imagine Bruce Bochy managing a combined no-hitter would be like.
I feel like we need to like find rides for every manager's style of no-hitter management.
That's gonna be next week's episode. It's just gonna be a tour of a theme park.
So yeah, Bruce Bochy, please never manage a combined no-hitter. Now, changing gears to minor league baseball. This week, the Reno Aces, the Arizona's AAA affiliate, announced that they were hiring Emily Janson as their general manager. Janson is now the sixth female GM currently working in minor league baseball, and the only one at the AAA level, making her the highest-ranking female executive in minor league baseball. First of all, does it come as a surprise to either of you that there are currently six women serving as minor league GMs?
Well, I mean, when you look at minor league GMs as if it were a game of bumper cars. I think on one hand, it is surprising, just because I've never thought to investigate it before now, but also there are so many minor league teams that even, you know, six women is probably in line with the general percentage of women in positions across Major League Baseball.
Yeah, there are 248 minor league teams. I looked this up because I was curious. And so that's like 2% of teams that have women as GMs. And I mean, it's a better percentage than Major League Baseball. So, you know, that's it's a start. But, you know, you wonder like, okay, how is this as far as like some of these women are going to get to go? Are they going to be able to go beyond this? You know, what is the meaning? And like, obviously, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a minor league GM. You know, that's for some people that's are for, you know, it's obviously a great achievement to get to that point. But, you know, you would like to see that this is the sort of thing that doesn't just have a place where it stops completely and that there's still going to be room for advancement.
Yeah, for me, I was not particularly surprised. And I think because of my, you know, my background with being at so many minor league baseball parks, at a time in 2013, the California League actually had two women serving as GMs, one for the Visalia Rawhide, the other for the Bakersfield Blaze, RIP. And now that the league is down to 8 teams, again, RIP Bakersfield Blaze and the High Desert Mavericks. Visalia's GM is still a woman. It's still the same woman who's been there since, I believe, 2010. So it's not particularly surprising to me, just more disappointing that it's 6 out of 248, was it? So yeah, it's still the percentages that are disappointing, but not the fact that there are minor league GMs. So going off that, which do we think we'll see first? A woman drafted by a major league organization or a woman working as a GM from an MLB team?
Oh, that's so difficult. I think it's probably going to be a GM, because there's just, I mean, not that there isn't, you know, in the professional world, but there's just so much misogyny in baseball, you know, from such a young age where women are, you know, heavily discouraged from pursuing a career in baseball. And I think that is changing, but I think it'll still be a while before we see a woman drafted, unless it's a team that wants to, you know, make a statement and draft a woman and then just kind of discard her somewhere. So I think that in terms of, you know, a Major League Baseball organization drafting, you know, a legitimate woman player who they're going to give an actual shot to, I think that we'll probably see a GM first.
Yeah, I think we have had women, or at least one woman who has been considered for GM jobs. I'm thinking of Kim Ng here. And so we've definitely been close to the point where there's been a woman general manager. And, you know, don't see why that couldn't be the case again. Think that because of that, it seems likely that we'll hit that before we hit a woman being drafted. As we've talked about here, you know, women's involvement in playing baseball, that's on the rise. And, you know, that's something that is starting to be understood that it's an option that's available. But I think it's going to take a while to sort of see the effects of that. So for that reason, I'm going with a woman as a GM first.
Yeah, I would like to say that, yes, I agree. I think it's going to be a woman as a GM before a woman being drafted by a major league organization, especially knowing that, you know, having co-created the non-cis men in baseball analytics network, knowing that there's at least 60 women, trans, non-binary people who are interested in analytics, and a lot of them are actually working professionally in some capacity. I just think that the chances are a lot higher. Also, I think one underlooked fact is that Sarah Gellies of the Baltimore Orioles is actually the director of analytics and major league contracts for the team, and it's very likely if she pursues the opportunity that she could become a major league GM, and it wouldn't just be Kim Ng, whose name is in the running. And while I understand, like, a lot of people are championing Kim Ng to be a major league GM, I think one of the things that isn't remembered that much is that she has a higher position in the league office. And it's one of those things where it's like, I don't understand why Kim Ng would leave such a high-ranking position to go be general manager of a baseball team. But I think Sarah Gellies would be probably the first in line if there is a GM opening and she goes for it. She's just been really great at her job and creating an analytics team for the Orioles. And I think, you know, I think that she's not going to be the last person we see heading up something in baseball operations. I think there's so much more, and especially knowing that more and more women are going into baseball analytics, and, you know, just the recent hirings this past offseason, there's been so many women either working as an intern, a fellow, or just full-time in baseball ops that I think is just going to be a lot more likely. Speaking of women in baseball, we are now joined by Hardball Times, Baseball America, the Australian Baseball League, and Canadian Baseball Network contributor and director of baseball information for the Great Lakes Canadians, Alexis Brodnicki. How are you today, Alexis?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Your article for The Love of the Game, My Time at MLB Scout School, was published at Hardball Times on Wednesday. For those who haven't had the opportunity to read it, can you provide a quick summary for us?
Yeah, I just kind of recount my experience going into scout school a little bit, what I was thinking about it, what I thought it would be, how I guess I kind of approached it a little bit, and what my time at scout school was actually like, which was a bit of an emotional roller coaster for me. I tried to be as honest as I could in the piece about the good times and the bad, and there were kind of a few more bad times at the beginning, and it got better as I went along. But just my total experience at scout school while I was there, and kind of every thought in my head along the way.
So what drew you to scouting school, and what was the selection process like for being the Blue Jays representative?
I got into baseball, working in baseball. I've always loved baseball my whole life, but I started working in baseball in 2010. I started working for the Blue Jays in the control room as a statistician and a scoreboard operator. So I worked kind of in the scoreboard room, and I thought that kind of would be a foot in the door to doing more in baseball. I love that job, and it was great, but I definitely wanted to keep pushing and moving forward. And along the way, I really got into Canadian baseball coverage. I've written tons about Canadian baseball players in every age group, every baseball scenario, in independent ball, in the big leagues, in the minor leagues, in high school, in college. And I really, over time, was drawn to the development side of the game. I really kind of enjoyed the process a little more than I enjoyed the big leagues, which was definitely new to me, because as a fan growing up, the big leagues were all I really saw. And I certainly got more interested in the development side, and I really wanted to know more about that, learn more about that. And scout school was a great way for me to do that. And I knew I wanted to go to scout school, and there were rumors the year before I went that it was not going to be a thing anymore. So I pushed really hard the year prior to try and go, kind of made it known to everybody in every organization I knew that I wanted to go to scout school. And I didn't get to go that year, and thankfully it continued. And actually, when the Blue Jays hired Mark Shapiro, and he came from the Indians, I had a meeting with him, thanks to a friend that I have with the Indians, Matt Foreman, who I worked with at Baseball America. And he kind of made an introduction, and I got to have a sit down with Mark Shapiro, which a lot of people, you know, aren't fortunate enough to be able to be in a position to do that, but I was. And he kind of asked what I was looking to do, how I was looking to move forward. And one of the suggestions he made was that I go to scout school, and I jumped on it right away. I was like, yep. And let's do that. Please, let's do that right away. As soon as we can, let's make it official. And so there wasn't a big selection process. I mean, each team gets to send a couple people each season. So luckily I got to meet with him, I guess, early enough in the year that somebody else hadn't received that spot. So I think I was just fortunate in timing and in getting to meet with him to be able to get to do that.
So your piece really seems to have resonated with a lot of people who have been in similar situations, initially feeling out of place in male-dominated spaces. Were you expecting this kind of reaction to it?
I wasn't sure. It's always hard, I guess, when you kind of, especially I find, as a female in the male-dominated world of baseball, it is hard to be super honest and to let people know that when I was at scout school, I cried because, you know, there's people who are very of the school of thought that there's no crying in baseball. And if you can't hack it, just move on. Or if you can't hack it with the big boys, then you don't belong, and that kind of attitude. So I was definitely worried about that because I have kind of received some of that attitude along the way over the last decade. So it would resonate with some other people who are just kind of struggling to find their way. There are so few jobs in baseball and so many people who want them that it is really hard. And it's a space that definitely needs to continue to diversify. So I think it's just really hard. And I know other people who feel that way as well, but I also know other people who just think that if it's hard, you should just suck it up and not say anything about it. So I wasn't really sure what the reaction would be. I'm glad it's been majority positive stuff, but I was definitely nervous about that for sure.
Yeah, I think we all have those nerves whenever we're publishing any sort of piece that is more on the personal side. So you mentioned in your article that one of the most difficult things about scouting is the amount of patience it requires. In addition to that, what is the biggest piece of advice that you could give to somebody who is in a marginalized community who wants to become a scout?
I think definitely the biggest piece of advice I would say is to listen to everybody around you. If you're going to games, if that's what you want to do, is to be in baseball, I mean, number one, you have to go to games. And number two, I think just listen to the people around you, introduce yourself, and everybody has something to offer. Everybody knows something. And whether you think you already know it or not, I think it's helpful. Really go to as many games as possible. That's probably the biggest thing. Even at scout school, when even just coming up with player comparisons for every player we wrote a scouting report on, we had to compare them to a current or former major league player. And I think just the time I had in the control room with the Blue Jays watching games, even on TV, seeing those guys at the stadium too, it really helped me with player comparisons and just seeing as many games as possible, talking to as many people as possible, are probably the biggest things I would suggest.
That seems to be really great advice.
Yeah, I was going to say that's definitely great advice, and also the advice that I heard myself when I started getting more into watching minor league baseball. So thank you for your time today, Alexis. You can follow Alexis on Twitter at BaseballAlexis and read her article at Fangraphs.com/THT, both of which we encourage you to do. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at Hardball_Times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. And you can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. And the podcast is on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.